As always, the main issue for Indonesian politicians and Indonesian voters is effective government.
Indonesia's presidential election is today. It's Wednesday, April 17th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us today. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, an Australian family reunited in Syria, land dwellers at risk in Myanmar, long strands of Chinese business opportunities, warm fabric, and a new scooter to ride. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Some 193 million Indonesians are set to start voting in presidential and parliamentary elections today, after campaigns focused on the economy, but with political Islam looming ever larger in the world's biggest Muslim-majority nation. President Joko Widodo, the first Indonesian president from outside the Jakarta elite, is competing against Prabowo Subianto, a former special forces general from the area of authoritarian rule under military dictator Suharto. Opinion polls show Widodo has a large lead over his challenger, whose campaign has repeatedly alleged major irregularities with voter rolls. Tom Popinski is a professor of government at Cornell University. He is a specialist in Southeast Asia and has great experience in Indonesia. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked him what he thought were the top issues facing Indonesian voters.
As always, the main issue for Indonesian politicians and Indonesian voters is effective government. Indonesia is a country which is a lower middle income country with aspirations to leap into the ranks of upper middle income and then developed countries in the next half century. But it's a country that's also marked by great inequality, both within across classes and across regions of this large country. And so one issue is always going to be the state of the economy, who's better able to provide for the needs of ordinary Indonesians, and who has a better plan for increasing, as the Indonesians would say, the prosperity of the Indonesian people. So this is one issue for sure. This is centered around, in particular, the question of infrastructure. Indonesia is a country of 10,000 islands, a large and diverse country, and so getting people and goods from place to place is actually not easy to do in Indonesia. Joko Widodo has campaigned on his successes in providing for infrastructural development. Jakarta has a new subway, which is set to open very soon. And so these are issues that are first and foremost in the minds of Indonesian voters. There is, though, the issue of religion and identity, which is always in the background in Indonesian politics. This is a proudly diverse country. It is not a Islamic state, although the population is about 88% Muslim. And so there is a question about what is the proper role for Islam in Indonesian public life. And in broad terms, you can view this as a contest between a candidate who represents a more explicitly Islamist vision for Indonesia's future and a more explicitly multi-ethnic and multi-religious vision.
Now, Indonesia does have the world's largest Muslim population. Is that correct?
That's right. There's about 230 million Muslims in Indonesia, which is more Muslims than in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran, and Turkey combined.
Talked about infrastructure. Indonesia has accepted a lot of money, a lot of projects from China. Is this an election issue as well?
This is not an election issue in the way that you might imagine, because neither candidate has really focused on China as a strategic threat in the terms of infrastructure cooperation. It is fair to say that Indonesians are generally wary of becoming overly reliant on China. At the same time, China is the source of a lot of development financing. And so both sides are increasingly aware of the need to find the right way to manage that relationship.
There have been reports of possible fraud, especially the discovery of what are thought to be fraudulent ballots in a warehouse several weeks ago. What's the overall feeling about that?
Certainly, Indonesians are going to be very vigilant about the fate of about the conduct of the elections coming up. I do think that there is a marginally greater chance that we'll see an effort by certain politicians or certain camps to push the elections in one direction or another using fraudulent means. But I've seen no credible evidence that this is going to be a threat to the overall integrity of the elections writ large. Well, we should expect these to be largely free and fair.
Well, you know, you have seen maybe even close up violence during elections in that country, have you not?
There have been instances of violence in elections, but this is not the type of thing that is generally concerning. 2014 did not see any systematic incidents of violence, and I don't see any particular reason to suspect that violence will be taking place in advance of the elections at all. It's always possible, I suppose, that we would see violence in the wake of the elections, but I don't see this as a particularly large threat.
Do you see a real challenge to Widodo here or not?
If we were to believe the polls, he leads by a comfortable margin. Does not seem to be as large as the margin by which he won last time, which was about 6%. But I do think that he can be fairly confident that he's going to win in this election. And if Prabowo were to defeat him, it would be a pretty substantial upset.
What other issues are relevant here? What other issues are cropping up right before the election starts?
Indonesians are particularly worried about fake news and the use of online means to discredit particular candidates. Jokowi in particular has been fairly aggressive against online critics of his government. He's used the resources of the legal system and the police to go after some of his more prominent critics. And so there are some issues about and concerns about whether or not Indonesian debate is as free and fair as it might be. I mean, one of the costs of clamping down on rumors and speculation and fake news is that you clamp down on criticism as well. So this is an issue to watch going forward.
That's worldwide, that issue, isn't it?
This is true. Indonesia, though, has a fairly effective and a legal system which allows the government to clamp down on online expression in ways that we don't see nearly as commonly in other countries. And there are good reasons to suspect that this has been used in ways that favor the incumbent ticket over the challengers.
So you think this is going to be a pretty safe, pretty predictable election?
My anticipation is that we'll have an election which is conducted largely freely and fairly. There may be some incidents or some irregularities, especially in more remote areas of Indonesia. I don't anticipate any violence, either inter-ethnic or inter-religious, as a consequence of this. And I do think that the real question for Indonesia is not who's going to win the presidential election, but how will the legislative elections shape up, because that's going to determine the balance of political power within the country's legislature.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking via Skype with Tom Popinski, a professor of government at Cornell University. Voters begin casting their ballots at 7 a.m. Indonesia time. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Kim set to meet Putin with Trump on both men's minds. President Tsai says Chinese drills threaten Taiwan, but it's not intimidated. Indonesia readies for presidential vote. Diplomacy blooms as China invites Vatican to join Garden Expo. Men still have an edge in communist Vietnam's gender-equal system. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and a whole lot more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. After 5 years and two failed rescue missions, an Australian grandmother has been reunited with her three surviving grandchildren and two great-grandchildren in a refugee camp in northeast Syria. They were taken by their Australian parents to the Middle East in 2014 to join the group calling itself Islamic State. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
From her home in suburban Sydney, Karen Nettleton has for years tried to free her grandchildren from their nightmare in Syria. They were orphaned in the conflict and are living in a Kurdish-controlled refugee camp after fleeing Baghouz, the Islamic State's final stronghold. 17-year-old Zainab has two children of her own and is expecting another. Two of her brothers were killed in an airstrike alongside their father, Khaled Sharouf, a notorious Islamic State fighter, who infamously posted a picture of his young son holding up a severed head in the city of Raqqa. In 2005, Sharouf pleaded guilty to preparing an act of terrorism in Australia and was jailed for 4 years. He would later leave the country on his brother's passport. His wife Tara, a convert to Islam, died from intestinal problems in the war zone. Australian authorities have told Karen Nettleton her grandchildren will soon be released into her care.
Well, the government has said that they will provide all of those, like the de-radicalisation and any assistance that we need in getting the children back into society. They'll help us do that. And they're not a threat or a danger to anyone. They're not.
It's unclear, however, how long it will take to repatriate the children, who say they were desperate to escape life under Islamic militants. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says his government wants to help them return home.
Where there are particularly children, then we are working with the Red Cross that where they're in a position for people to get to a place where they might be in a position to return to Australia, then we will cooperate with that process.
Nettleton's story has been documented by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She'd previously flown to Turkey twice to try to rescue the children, but was forced to return empty-handed. It's estimated there are 70 children born to Australian citizens in refugee camps, which are holding tens of thousands of wives and children of Islamic State fighters. Campaigners argue the children are the victims of horrific decisions made by their parents and must be allowed home. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, President Tsai Ing-wen says Taiwan is not intimidated by China's military drills this week after the latest Chinese military maneuvers were denounced by a senior U.S. official as coercion and a threat to stability in the region. China's People's Liberation Army describes the drill as routine. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us as we spend another day together at VOA Asia. In Myanmar, decades of conflict and displacement have left swaths of land abandoned and undocumented, especially in the ethnic regions. In 2012, the Vacant, Fallow, and Virgin Lands Management Law was enacted, classifying about one-third of Myanmar's land as such, and instructing land dwellers to register the land they were occupying or using to obtain a 30-year permit. Last month's deadline to obtain the permit has passed, leaving thousands of land dwellers at risk of being driven off their property or worse, being charged with trespassing and thrown in jail. Steve Sanford spoke with landowners, farmers, and rights activists in Karen State about the adverse effects of the 2012 land law.
In the village of Nong Talar, land ownership has traditionally been regulated by a customary tenure system, with the community sharing in local resources. But last month's deadline to register for permits has come and gone, leaving many locals wondering where they stand on ownership rights. Imposing Burmese-regulated laws and penalties in ethnic areas that are still negotiating a ceasefire could create more conflict, says local rights activists.
The real problem is that the armed group organizations also have their own administration, and at the same time, the government is using this Vacant Fallow Virgin Land Management Law to expand the administration into the armed organization's territories.
Land confiscation is common in the conflict areas, and the added complication of filing legal documents heightens the problem for small-scale farmers who lack formal land titles. Massive agribusinesses aided by armed groups on both sides of the fighting have laid claim to much of the abandoned land.
The local army, they forced me to sell them the land. They came to me with the money and handed 10,000 kyat to me and said, "You're going to sell the land to us or not. If you don't sell it to us, we'll take the money back." Then they left us with the money. We can't do anything.
As more refugees return home, finding legal resettlement areas is a growing problem, especially in the national government-controlled regions. And for those who have already resettled without official documentation, the risk of facing future legal battles against big businesses is a concern.
I do not have any hope or expect any miracle. I have no idea what I should be doing. If I am not around in the future, I will pass the land on to my daughter. Can I do that? I don't understand about the law.
Steve Sanford for VOA News in Karen State, Myanmar.
Coming up, don't flip your wig. Buy it from China. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, a Kremlin spokesman says preparations for a long-rumored Kim Putin summit are underway. Reports say the meeting could happen as soon as next week. Kim, whose government is being squeezed by international sanctions, is likely to push Putin for economic aid. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for great stories and features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. Now, as VOA Asia continues, we comb through the Chinese wig business in Africa while an Indian airline is grounded. These are the stories on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Africa has become a huge market for Chinese wigs. Wearing a wig or adding extensions is a popular trend throughout the African continent, and many of those hair products are now imported from China. In 2017, China exported $3.2 billion worth of hair products, with Africa being its second largest market. Ni Qianqin is the manager of the wig section at AliExpress.
The trading volume of wigs in European and American markets increased some 50% year on year, but it's up by 100 to 300% year on year in the African market.
Many credit the development of the e-commerce sector in China for the rapid increase in wig sales. China has seen huge growth in its e-commerce sector during the past decade. The volume of e-commerce trade has shot up almost 10 times, from $468 billion in 2008 to $4.7 trillion in 2018. Closer relationships and more in-depth cooperation between China and African countries in recent years has also resulted in a higher number of wig sales to the African continent. Jessica is a 22-year-old Congolese businesswoman who frequently purchases wigs from China.
I come 3 times a year, and when I come, I take 10,000 pesos, and he cost me $200,000.
While synthetic hair products are the most popular sellers in Africa, as some of those economies improve, more customers are now buying the more expensive human hair products. Thousands of passengers in India have been stranded this week because Jet Airways has run out of funding. Jet Airways is India's second largest airline, but it is now close to going under with debts of more than $1 billion. The carrier was forced to reduce operations after months of defaulting on loans and struggling to pay its staff. At a protest in Mumbai's airport last Friday, employees pleaded for help. Raman Sharma is a pilot for Jet Airways.
We need the infusion of funds today, not after 1 week when it's too late. What is the point of getting the funds when most of the fleet is grounded? We need to get the funds back, pay the people, get the planes in the air, make it convenient for passengers, and let's start earning revenue.
Alarm bells for Jet Airways first rang in August when it failed to report its quarterly earnings or pay staff, including pilots. It later reported a loss of around $85 million. Fluctuating global crude prices, a weak rupee, and fierce competition from budget rivals all played a role in the carrier's demise. Jet Airways was also impacted last year when the government imposed a 5% import tax on jet fuel, even as petroleum prices worldwide rose. Dimpy Prakash is an aircraft maintenance engineer at Jet Airways.
Now the feeling is of also of despair, frustration. Like, we want our salaries, at the same time we want to save our airlines.
Jet Airways is currently operating a minimum number of aircraft and is flying on very few routes, only inside of India. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. A dog found swimming more than 220 kilometers from shore by workers on an oil rig crew in the Gulf of Thailand has been returned safely to land. The crew managed to rescue the dog by putting a rope around its neck and hauling it up. The crew thinks the dog might have fallen off of a fishing trawler. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to tell us about a temperature-adjusting fabric.
This is Science in a Minute.
There is clothing that can help cool you down on hot days, and of course there are a number of clothing options for keeping warm on colder days. Now researchers at the University of Maryland say they have developed a new fabric that not only can cool or warm, but can automatically sense conditions to determine which mode to activate. On hot days, the fabric opens up and allows body heat to escape. On cold days, it limits the amount of heat that is allowed to pass through it, allowing the body to retain heat. The researchers say their new fabric is made with a special yarn that consists of fibers of two different synthetic materials. The yarn is then coated with carbon nanotubes, which is considered to be a unique type of lightweight and conductive metal. The developers admit that more research must be conducted before the fabric can be made available commercially. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The manufacturer of the iconic Italian scooter Vespa makes another line of noisy but affordable three-wheel transportation vehicles. The name literally means bee in Italian, and fans of the motorized tricycle hummed across the Tuscan countryside to celebrate more than 70 years of its production. Arash Arabisadi has the buzz.
Vespa, the iconic Italian scooter, has a slightly bigger brother called the Ape.
L'Ape è bello perché devi provarlo.
The Ape is beautiful. You have to try it. It takes you back. All of us Ape owners are old men, and we want to be young again.
It has three wheels and a roof, handlebars for steering, and a flatbed in the rear. The Ape, much like the Vespa, was made famous for affordability.
As a child, I lived in the countryside. The Ape was the means of transportation for everyone. Workers, carpenters, artisans, farmers. The Ape was the vehicle to run the small economy of a village. Everyone could afford it.
These Ape fans celebrate more than 70 years of its production. They toured the Tuscan countryside before showcasing their custom wheels in the town of Pontedera. Ape owner Stefan tours the continent in his custom van turned mobile home.
This is my lovely Ape camper. So I created this 10 years ago. I create the cabin and I travel around Europe in my vacation and join the land, the people. We have always nice time together. People want to look, what is this? Oh, I never saw this. And this is unique. It's really unique.
Others say the Ape takes them back through time.
For me, the Ape means becoming children again. It happens to all of us. Climb in and somehow you're a kid again.
Ape in Italian literally means bee, like the flying insect. Farmers today still use it for transport. A new one costs around $5,600. The riders say looking cool is worth the price. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. A great way to hear our program is on the radio. Many great radio stations around Asia have our program, like Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned into our program today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Cedric Franklin, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our great VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.